Oliver Wendell Holmes said, "One's mind, once stretched by a new experience, can never go back to its old dimensions." In this podcast, we are proud to present our guests, the world leaders and pioneers in the fields of neurointerventional surgery, interventional radiology, and endovascular neurosurgery. We will bring you through their personal journey and the three cases that have marked their professional career. From the very first to the very last case, passing by the most enriching and challenging, welcome to this original format by Link Online, my first, my last, my everything. Hi everyone, my name is Nantia Suchichantararat, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Lanzino. Dr. Lanzino is a professor of neurosurgery and radiology at Mayo Clinic, Rochester, as well as Joseph and Barbara Ashkins, professor of surgery. Hi, Dr. Lanzino, how are you today?
Good, thank you.
So we usually always start from the beginning. Obviously, everyone is picked for this podcast because they are the thought leaders and the influencers of the field. But for those who may not be familiar with your path, can you walk us through the path that you took to get here?
So I did medical school in Italy, the University of Bologna. After finishing my medical school, moved to United States and did research at the University of Pittsburgh first and at the University of Virginia afterwards. Then I started my formal training in neurosurgery. And during the training in neurosurgery, as the modern field of endovascular neurosurgery was starting, I was allowed to focus for 2 years in the University of Buffalo in New York, doing a fellowship in neuroendovascular surgery. So at that time, I was in the mid-90s, one of the first neurosurgeons in the United States to have that unique training, both in endovascular neurosurgery and open traditional neurosurgery. After finishing my formal training in neurosurgery, I spent an additional year in the Barrow Neurological Institute in Phoenix with Dr. Spetzler. And in 2002, started my own independent practice in academic neurosurgery, first at the University of Illinois in Peoria, and then I moved to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester in 2008.
So you are in a very unique position. A lot of us say we are dual trained, but you truly are dual trained in a sense that you did two separate fellowships that are very, very highly ranked fellowships. How do you see open neurosurgery being incorporated into the career of young attendings that are coming out in practice in neurosurgery?
I think open neurosurgery with all different aspects of neurosurgery as a very important and integral part of any clinical practice and that focus in neurovascular disease. As I see younger colleagues that are coming out of training, I think that this is an incredible time because the training is different and in a way as shortened compared to what we had to do when I and other pioneers, so to speak, did it. There are a lot of opportunities nowadays on the endovascular field with the simulation, that the neuroendovascular simulations is basically similar to the clinical experience. Of course, the emotional aspects are different. In terms of the open vascular neurosurgery and vascular experience, there is no question that there are less aneurysms that are operated today when compared to the 90s and even early 2000s. But at the same time, there are unique and incredible opportunity for training that can be done without any physical moving. The amount of information and high-quality education that is available online, the Roton collection, thousands of videos of masters in neurosurgery that are openly and widely available are all resources that were not available when I trained. And I strongly suggest to young colleagues in training and young colleagues coming out of training to really make full use and maximize their utilizations, because I think those are incredible resources. Just I remember when I want to go and visit master neurosurgeon, it would take a lot of time to make all the arrangements and a lot of financial and time resources to be there for maximum of a week, too, just to see a few cases. And the fact that all that now it's available with the click of a computer in the evening in our own living room, I think it's an incredible resource that with other similar educational tools can compensate for what might be the lack of high number of cases to practice or learn.
I'm going to shift gear a little bit. Whose career inspires you and why? Who is your inspiration if you had to pick one or two people?
Well, I think that I was lucky to train and to encounter different faces, people that have been very instrumental in inspiring me but also guiding me. I think I've been so lucky to be able to work and get to know personally so many masters in the field that would be almost too many to name briefly in this podcast. But starting with my early teachers at Bellaria Hospital in Bologna, Dr. Testa, Andreoli, and Calbucci, that really in the late 80s gave me the basic guidance but also instilled in me the basic principles of passion, total dedication to the patient care, and constant drive to do better.
So in line with that, what would you say to the new attending or trainees coming out of practice? What do you wish that you had known, or what would you have done differently?
Well, there is really nothing that I would have done differently. I would tell them I started my residency 5 years after finishing medical school and only did the formal residency but also two additional fellowships. So I would say take the time that you need to be able to come out the best possible physician and neurosurgeon you can. I would strongly encourage young people to follow their passion. And while it is important to stay flexible and have an open mind because technology improves, the field changes, at the same time I learned that it's very difficult to make exact predictions about the future direction of the specialty. So I would strongly encourage to follow their passion, stay focused, but at the same time have that flexibility that if there is any major innovation or change, be ready to embrace it.
What do you see as the next frontier of our field?
Well, the improvements that have been made in the field of cerebrovascular disease in the past 30 years have been really incredible. If we look at the treatment of acute ischemic stroke alone, when I started, there was a nihilistic approach. Patients with acute ischemic strokes were not even admitted to specialized neurological units because the feeling was that there was very little that could be done to reverse the damage related to the stroke. There have been incremental improvements in the way we do and we conduct surgical operations, where outcomes that were taken for granted 30 years ago are not acceptable anymore if we only think about the amount of brain retraction that we used to apply when doing aneurysm surgery. It's something that nowadays it would not be. The CT scan or the MRI after a brain surgical procedure is not pristine. It's something that today would be considered substandard. And that has been reflected in significant improvement of the outcome of these patients. Of course, we can always do better. Early on in my career, I became fixated on trying to achieve the goal of zero morbidity and mortality. And with the smart utilization of all the resources available, the tools and different techniques available, I think we are very close to achieve that goal for the vast majority of problems that we face. There are situations like giant aneurysms or dolichoectatic vertebrobasilar aneurysm, like we say, that's really the last frontier where, despite all the advances, we really do not have a satisfactory treatment. But luckily, it's a very small percentage of the patients that we encounter because it's a relatively uncommon problem. And I think that the next frontier is going to be more of a physician who is an expert on the pathology, independent on the type of treatment. And there is no question that even as surgeons, we need to get more and more involved in preventive measures and also continue to stay involved in the research, because there is no question that medical treatments, as well as better and more focused imaging, will be major advances that will shape our discipline as we move in the future.
Now we will move on to the three cases that we asked everyone about. Do you remember the first case that you did as an attending and what it was?
I remember very well. It was after I finished my training. There was a slight delay in obtaining a state license so that I could start my practice in Illinois. And the same day the license finally went through, I was called in the middle of the night by one of my colleagues because there was an elderly lady with a large ruptured middle cerebral artery aneurysm. And that was something that at that time our practice was to go directly to treatment. Majority of those patients in those days were still being treated with the open surgical treatment, especially for a middle cerebral artery. This patient had not only a very large aneurysm, was calcified, but also she had a contralateral carotid occlusion that made the procedure still even first more challenging. First case as an attending, everybody watching over my shoulder. What I learned from that case, among many lessons, first of all, I was surprised in a way by how calm I was despite the circumstances. And I realized that one of the main major qualities that we need to master and learn is the ability to stay calm, especially when you are supposed to face a challenging situation. And the fact that we can train our brain to be able to do that, no matter the circumstances. And then the fact that surgery, no matter how difficult or challenging it is, it's a process. And a process is made of fairly basic steps. And many of those steps, if you have done your homework, in my case, was training, studying, and being lucky to have been exposed to many masters in the field. If you really go through those basic steps and you try to simplify as much as possible, the end result of the process, i.e. the surgical operation, quite often is a very good one. So a lot of lessons from that case, and the patient did well, and that got me kick-started in a new place, and we became quite a sort of a famous local case because everybody was expecting a not-so-excellent outcome eventually. So
the second case is the case that you feel is most memorable, most challenging, or most career-changing that you've had.
Oh, there are many cases, and cases that are more memorable are quite often the ones that didn't go as expected, didn't go well. And even after many years, you continue almost in a random fashion. Whenever things are quiet, particular case, the particular patient comes back to your mind and you start replaying what happened and what you could have done different. But if I need to pick a particular case, I remember very well a very challenging giant vertebrobasilar junction aneurysm in a patient that had come from far away, and she had minimal symptoms. And we were able to devise a strategy to treat her aneurysm. So we went from the incredible level of excitement for the fact that we were able to devise a strategy and treat the aneurysm and discharge the patient after a few days to 10 days later, the phone call that she started having some progressive weakness related to the fact that the aneurysm, because of the treatment, it started swelling in a delayed fashion. But at the time, of course, you never know, is it related to stroke, a thromboembolic complication, or is progressive mass effect, and this progressive mass effect is something that you're going to be able to get control. So we started on steroids, and over a period of months, she was able to make a full recovery, and now she's several years out. So I think the case I would consider emblematic and representative because it's a little bit a summary of vascular neurosurgery. It's easy to go through incredible excitement for very good results to being down and incredibly upset because things can turn for the worse and when you don't expect that anymore. And then if you fight with your teeth, it's not uncommon that you are able to fix something and then eventually good results. So the case really stuck with me because it really summarizes what we often go through.
And just to clarify, this is an unruptured, symptomatic,
giant
aneurysm.
Posterior circulation aneurysm.
And this was before or after, this is after pipeline and everything
this
became
was,
available?
I would say likely that was after pipeline because flow diversion with coils, with occlusion of one of the two branches of the fenestration that is always in this vertebrobasilar junction aneurysm, we were able to devise a complex strategy that eventually turn out to be successful.
Now, do you discharge everyone on steroids for these now?
Well,
we do. So
I definitely learned to be more careful and think about when there is that risk and to be a little bit more aggressive with medical therapy in this particular situation, steroids.
These are frustrating disease, no doubt. So for the last case, do you remember the last case that you did prior to coming here today?
Oh, yes, I do, because, again, that was another case that summarized a lot of the emotions that we go through. It's a case of a young lady with rupture dissecting pseudoaneurysm of the middle cerebral artery on the left side coming off on a opercular branch. And that case is memorable because 37-year-old patient with two young children and a very upset family in bad clinical condition. And in that case, the decision we made was to go ahead in the middle of the night because she had presented with symptoms and the pseudoaneurysm ruptured after a few hours. So we realized that it was a bad actor. And the case was memorable because of the ability to devise a strategy that was so far successful in taking care of the aneurysm, but also minimize any potential additional damage and yet being able to reverse even the effects of the primary bleed within a few hours. And with so far, it's of course, it's always early to say anything because she's only 7 days from a bed subarachnoid hemorrhage, but she's in the intensive care unit. The pseudoaneurysm is closed, and so far she's doing very well. That's, you know, I like to conclude with strong reminder to younger colleagues. There is no question that one of the main reasons why we are attracted to this specialty is because of the complexity and because we all, including myself, were fascinated by the technical gesture, by the acrobatics. But more and more, as much as it might not be fancy, but I learned that it's really much more about understanding the disease and devising the best possible strategy with the idea that we're not in the 80s anymore, where if you have an aneurysm and you go home and you are able to take care of yourself, but you might still have headaches, you might still feel tired all the time. Well, cognitive function might not be the same. Well, nowadays, all those are the outcome. It's not about the hemiplegia, the aphasia anymore. Nowadays, it's about making sure that the person who has a bad subarachnoid hemorrhage, after 3 months, that person should be back to the pre-subarachnoid hemorrhage condition. And for the vast majority of patients that come to our hospitals in grade 1 through 4, if that doesn't happen, it's often because we have made mistakes that in the setting of a ruptured aneurysm, it's very easy to hide behind the effects of the primary bleed, the hydrocephalus, the vasospasm. But I learned that that should be our goal, and it's possible in the vast majority of patients, and we have to be careful not to hide behind easy excuses. So again, the message to young colleagues should be, yes, the technical aspects are fascinating, but more and more to achieve excellent results is much more about knowledge of the disease and choosing the correct strategy.
Such a good point. Just out of curiosity, this is not part of the segment, but what are some of the things that your fellows would say are so Lanzino? So for example, I trained under Dr. Charles Matouk, and his thing was no magical thinking. What are some of the things that your fellows would say?
Actually,
say all the time.
One of my fellows finished a fellowship. You might find it on Twitter, but
I think I know him.
I think it's all about the strategy, and never become complacent. And let's find ways how we can do better. So I think these are the most common Lanzinoisms that you might hear.
Very well. So the last question for you before we leave today is, what do you hope to leave as a legacy in the field?
I think that each one of us, especially in academics, we can amplify the effects of what we have learned and what we do by training future generations. I think my legacy will be through the residents, students that I've been in contact, and I hope that I was able to instill and transfer some basic sound principles that can help them in continuing what I've done the past 30 years.
Dr. Lanzino, thank you so much for spending the time with us today.
Thank you for having me.